Hello, and welcome to the Preview Spotlight Interviews on the Comic Book Page podcast. My name is John Mayer.
And I'm Bob Bretall. In this episode, we'll be talking with creators about upcoming projects available in the current month's previews catalog. Now I'm talking to Josh Williamson, who is the author of author and creator of Xenoholics from Image Comics, and he's also writing a series that's in the catalog from DC called Uncharted. Thanks for joining me.
Hey, Bob. How you doing?
Let's talk about Xenoholics first. We've got issue number 2 in this month's order form. Issue number 1 came out last month, although people can probably still ask for it at their comic shop if it didn't hit their radar last month. It was on a special discount, the number 1 issue from DCBS last month. It was 50% off, and we've got issue number 2 out. This looks like a really fun series. Let's give us the high concept.
High concept is Xenoholics is about a group of people who believe they were abducted by aliens, and they start going like an Alcoholics Anonymous for people who believe they're abducted by aliens. And while they're there, something happens that makes them want to prove what happened to them really happened. And so we kind of follow along with these 6 characters and their little journey trying to prove that they really were abducted, as they're being chased by a group of people called the Men in White, which is sort of like our version of the Men in Black, which is a twist on the idea. And that's what the project is about.
Okay, cool. Now, is this a limited series or is it ongoing?
No, it's ongoing. Actually, our plan is to go to issue 20. And that's where we want to go. If we can go past 20, we could, but we could in 3 end it right at 20. We could end it at 10 if we had to, but really we want to go all the way to 20. Right now with the current, comic marketplace, who knows? But we really do have a big story we want to tell, and we knew we couldn't contain it in a little mini series, so we're hoping to go all the way to 20 and then kind of wrap it all up. We have a definite ending plan. It's all layered out how we want to do this giant story about these people who believe they're abducted by aliens and just kind of go with them on their little journey.
Now, you're doing this with Seth DeMuse, if I pronounced that correctly.
Yeah, he did. Yeah.
Why don't you talk a little bit about working with Seth and Seth's designs for the characters in the world and how that's been going?
So we're going great. Seth is awesome. I mean, it was interesting. I knew him. He did a book called I Hate Gallant Girl for Image a few years back. And I liked his stuff a lot. I remember seeing his stuff and just being like following his blog and looking at different things that he was doing on DeviantArt and really thinking, wow, this guy is, really good. I like his really animated style and the facial expressions, and it felt like the characters were moving on the page almost. And so I started talking with different people about wanting to work with him, like Jim Valentino at Image, and kind of letting him know ahead of time, and he ended up introducing us. And then at C2E2 last year, we started talking about doing this book and what we had planned. And it's interesting, because originally I was thinking about doing a different kind of book with him, a more all-ages sort of book with him. And he was more interested in trying something different. He really wanted to do something involving like supernatural stuff. And I brought up this book kind of about aliens, and he was like, yeah, let's do that. I like X-Files. Let's try that. And I was like, well, it's a different take on X-Files, because whenever you see those movies, whenever you see an alien movie, like let's use Independence Day as an example, it's always about like a scientist or the government, or someone, this random like super smart person that is somehow getting involved. But if you watch Independence Day, there are those people who are standing on the top of the buildings with signs who want the aliens to come and visit them. Like, they're excited to see them. I was kind of interested in their story. And when I told that to Seth, he was like, yeah, I always thought that was interesting too. Let's do that. I'm with that. And what I did with the characters was I gave him some general ideas of what I wanted to do. And then he came back with stuff that was, I told him, like, let's not do anything cliche. This is me kind of fun. They just came back with a bunch of different designs for the characters that really nailed what I wanted, but with a twist to it, it really felt like Seth was adding his own take on things. And that was exactly what I wanted from him. And it actually changed the way I saw certain characters and kind of the way they were written in the book a little bit. Like, I went back through and rewrote things based on his designs, because his designs had so much character to them that I was able to go through and kind of say, okay, well, this, I originally had this idea for this character, but now this is better. This is going to be a much better take on this person.
So without getting into spoiler territory, let's talk a little bit about your main cast.
The main two guys that we really follow are this guy named Bob and Kyle. Bob is an ex-cop who was abducted. Before the story starts, you kind of get a little glimpse of his story in the very beginning of issue one. It's in the preview pages that we've been showing up online. But he, basically what happens, he gets abducted and it ruins his life. You know, his wife leaves, takes his kids with him, he loses his job, all these different things happen to him. And we kind of follow, and he kind of is the new person to this world of people who believe aliens are real. He's sort of this, you know, this guy who's just, it's kind of like how we all are, you know, where it's not really a thing we think about on a daily basis. You know, you might watch a movie, you might see a TV show, you might be on your radar, but you're not really thinking about it. And then it happens to you, and you're kind of thrown into this world that he didn't know existed, and how deep it goes, and what happens to these people. And so he's kind of the follow-through character. We're going to follow him through the series. And then there's Kyle, who... Kyle is sort of a mystery. Like you said, I don't want to get too much into spoilers, but Kyle is sort of a little jerk who's already a member of the group. He's been a member of the group for a while. But his reasons for being part of the group are a secret, and you learn the secret in issue one. That's sort of one of the catalysts of the book. But he sort of is lying about why he's there, and he basically followed the two of them as they go on this journey of, you know, I keep saying journey, but yeah, as they go try to discover what was really going on with these aliens. Are they real? Are they not? You know, are any of these people who are abducted telling the truth? That's one of the things we kind of try to push in the book, is who is telling the truth and who isn't. You know, are they all telling the truth? Are none telling the truth? I mean, I can tell you out of the six characters that are in there, at least one is telling the truth about what happened, and the rest are lying. So, or I should say the rest are lying. Some are lying, some are not. It's weird. You gotta...
Well, I mean, is it like, it's more like you can believe something and it's not actually the way that it happened, right?
Yeah,
I mean,
you can... There's one guy who something really bad did happen to him. I'm not going to say this guy. Something really bad happened to him, and he kind of believes he was abducted because of it.
So basically he projected some other event onto this alien abduction.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. It's interesting. I mean, I think that what people are going to read into it as they read the book, you know, are they going to figure out who's telling the truth, who isn't? You know, it's sort of a kind of a mystery in a way. Because you're not going to really know what's going on at first. Like, it's going to be one of those things where the first couple issues might feel kind of slow in some instances, because we're trying to build a mystery. I mean, that's what the whole thing is. It's a pretty big mystery. By the time we get to issue five, we can pretty much tell you what's going on. It's interesting because issue five is going to be set up to where by the beginning, I'm going to tell you, here's everything you need to know. This is it. I revealed it. This is it. This is what's happening in the book. Right? But then by the ending, we pull the rug out and say, like, nope, that's not it. This is over here. And that's kind of our thing with the book, is sort of building up on this bigger mystery until eventually it's all explained. And we won't leave anything unexplained. I mean, we're kind of like lost in a way where there's going to be layers of things, but we want to make sure by the ending everything is explained completely. I mean, in each issue, you're going to get at least enough information about each character to know whether or not they're telling the truth within each issue. We kind of set up to where each issue, at least one's true or false gets revealed, at least in the first few issues.
Now, you've got, sounds like you've got at least the broad strokes of this entire larger story arc kind of laid out, and have you got it to the point where you've got major story beats and events kind of mapped down to issues?
Yeah, we have landmarks down. I mean, I know the way almost every issue starts, because the way the book is, every issue opens almost exactly the same. You get a glimpse of a character's abduction story at the beginning of each issue and how that relates to that issue. So I have the themes down, and we have the landmarks down for everything after issue five. So 1 through 5 is tightly planned out. And then you also have that is sort of mapped out depending on, like I said, yeah, like landmarks. Like we need to hit this beat by this point. However, one reason why I've been kind of loose with that is because who knows what might change. You know, I might be going through and be like, you know what, this is a better story, or this is a better angle with this character, or whatever, you might change it. You know, I don't want to make it so that it's too plot-driven, because you never know what a character's going to do until you write them. So it's like I might be writing a character and then decide, hey, this book might actually go this way instead. I might want to change a few things. But that being said, I still won't leave things undone, you know, or I won't leave something unexplained. I want to make sure that by the end of it all, it's all there. We want to make sure we're not like X-Files, you know, like that's one of the main things, that aliens are in this book. You get to see aliens pretty quick. It's never something where we constantly hit aliens and you never see them. You'll get to see plenty of aliens in this book. And then you're going to see some weird stuff. Like issue two does have a mature reader's label on it, which was sort of a funny thing with us, because I went in one direction with it and then decided to cut back a little bit. And I talked to some different creators if we went too far in issue two, and it's been kind of debated. And so we might make some changes. We're not sure yet.
So kind of like this is the alien fetish club.
Yeah, we don't want to offend anybody. That's what I was going to say to you earlier. We don't want to offend anybody. So we're trying to make sure that it's kind of funny because I wrote in the script and we ended up with that the ending was kind of offensive possibly to some people. So we had to go back through and kind of make some changes to it to make sure that we didn't really, still mature readers, but I don't want to offend anybody.
Right.
We'll see what happens. People read it, what they think of it. But yeah, I mean, the book is really, it's sort of a book like Chew in a lot of ways where it's, I think at times hard to explain, but it's more about the characters and their interactions with each other. And then the aliens, then I guess a log line, you know, then I guess the Hollywood hype line, I suppose. But yeah, it's a lot about the characters and sort of this, what happens to each one of them as they grow, as the series goes on.
Well, I will put a link to the preview pages in the show notes. So if you're listening to this and this sounds interesting and you want to check it out, go look at the show notes. We'll have a link there. You can go and click on that, check out the preview pages, and then make sure if it does sound interesting to you that you do go to your local shop and ask them to order this for you. If you're an online customer of some online retailer, you can generally send them an email also. It's not, they're still able to put in orders and up their orders for these books. So even if you didn't send in an order for it on your first go-round, you can always go in and send them an email and say, hey, can you please add Xenoholics number one to my order for the month of, it would have been August.
Yeah, and the FOC hasn't passed yet either. I mean, so there's still time. But yeah, with this book, we really try to do something that was weird, that was unique, that wasn't like anything else on the shelves. Like compared to Chew, even like a book I did a few years ago called Necessary Evil, it has like a similar dark humor, dark but not really light, or not, you know what I mean, like that mixture of the two tone. Like I think that's the closest in tone to anything I've written is probably Necessary Evil. And now, like I said, Chew, I guess, is a more modern, popular thing, I guess, is in tone that we're trying to go for.
Very good. Now, the other book that you've got in the September previews catalog is from DC, and it's based on a PlayStation 3 video game, and it's called Uncharted. You got the first issue there. Why don't let's talk a little bit about Uncharted?
Yeah, Uncharted, you already kind of said a lot about it. You know, it's a video game series. It's a game series that I love. I think it's crazy popular. I didn't realize how popular it was. I mean, it's one of those things where I think I live in a bubble sometimes, because I play a video game, or I have friends that play a video game, but you don't realize this game is, like, crazy popular. I remember playing it last year, or, like, a year and a half ago now, I guess, and just being like, wow, this is a fun game, this is great, you know, it's, like, one of my favorite games. But then when the job became available, I started hearing from different people, and I realized how popular it was. Like, it's supposed to be, you know, one of the most, like, Uncharted 3 that comes out in November, the actual game, is, like, one of the most anticipated games of the year. But really what the game series is about is a sort of, like, a modern-day Indiana Jones about a guy named Nathan Drake, who is a descendant of Sir Francis Drake, the great, you know, legendary explorer. And what Nathan does is he goes around the world and tries to basically find relics and treasure hunting and all these kind of things for a mix of excitement and money, which is where I think separates him from Indiana Jones, is that he's a lot of it has to do with money. You know, he's not just, it's not just about putting it into a museum. It's about a quick buck at times.
So he's not like he's not some college professor or archaeologist or something that's in it for the intellectual pursuit. He's more of a adventurer, more in, you know, sort of along the lines of the way Lara Croft has been portrayed sometimes.
Well, even then, Lara Croft, I think, is just the excitement. You know, she's filthy rich, where Drake is not that at all. You know, he's not filthy rich. I mean, he kind of bums around a bit. I mean, he has money, but it's not really. You know, it's sort of this idea of this guy who's living paycheck to paycheck almost, or gig to gig, who constantly gets himself into trouble. And then somehow stumbles into these jobs backwards and ends up, these jobs become more about saving the world than just about his job. More about the money, you know, him, and you really get to see in each game him sort of evolve. And, I mean, the games are so much fun. We got, you know, with DC's doing the book, I've been working a lot with DC and with, Naughty Dog, which is the company that makes the game for Sony. Going back and forth with both of them about what kind of comic we want to do and really make sure that it was a comic that people who played the games, you know, could get into, like, they could definitely see it and feel it's in line with what they've already seen in the games, but at the same time make it accessible to a new reader, which is one of the bigger challenges because the mythology is so deep. But it's no different, and that's one thing about the game and writing a comic based on the video game. It's no different than working for DC or Marvel on anything else I've done, where it's like you're dealing with this character that has a huge mythology and a following, and you got to make sure that you stick in line with it. You know, if you write a character out of character, people are going to catch on really quick and they're not going to like it. So it was the same idea with this game of trying to make sure I wrote it in a way that made everybody happy.
So this is an all new story. It's kind of, is it bridging the second game to the third game? Is it just an untold adventure of Drake? You know, how's it kind of fit in? Because it's not, it doesn't look like it's just kind of going over ground that someone's going to be playing through when they play the video game. It's something new for them.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, it's a brand new adventure. It actually doesn't tie in directly with any game, but it tells the, how do I word this? It tells the story of two characters, how they met. I want to say who the other character is, but it basically tells you how Drake met another character that's a popular character from the games. But in the games, they never explain how these two characters meet, where that's what this comic does. It kind of goes into these two characters first meeting and sort of the little adventure they had before. I can tell you this, it does take place. It's ambiguous where with the first game it takes place, but it does take place before the second game. That much I know we can say for sure. But they really wanted kind of a little side adventure. Yeah, but it's definitely an all-new story. I mean, I came up with the idea myself and basically ran it by them and pitched it to them. I pitched them three different ideas. They liked two of them. They kind of wanted to mix them, and then we kind of ended up just going with one of the ideas by itself. We took out the mixing and just went with one of the ideas purely by itself and sort of ran with it. And it was really cool because I think it says on the citation, this is sort of a Journey to the Center of the Earth type of adventure. I love Journey to the Center of the Earth. So being able to do a story kind of like that in modern times with a character who is, that's not what he's about. It's not about going to the center of the earth for adventure or trying to scientific reasons. He's going, trying to find money essentially, like, you know, trying to find a way of getting rich, was a lot of fun to do.
Very cool. Another book that if you're interested in this one, you're going to want to ask your store to carry it. These video game tie-ins, it always baffles me that they don't sell better because these, at least in the comic shops, you know, because there's so much of a crossover between comic readers and people who play the video games. And I don't know if they actually get these things into video game stores through some mechanism other than Diamond. But it seems like the number of copies of these video games that the people buy, you know, if the people who play the games knew about them, they would be buying them. You know,
I think now with the new DCE, you know, DC Entertainment, I think they're better about getting out to people, you know, and getting in people's hands and letting people know about it. From what I understand, yeah, I mean, you look at things like Gears of War and Infamous and Deus Ex. I think they do get it in the hands of people who play video games through alternate methods, and it isn't counted in the numbers normally because it's gone through different methods. It's interesting because I know that a lot of times the Diamond numbers that are released are not, what's the word I want? Actually indicative of what's really going on. You know, I've learned that, like, the UK numbers don't count. And
right.
If they sell directly to a GameStop, they don't count as much, or if they're sold as a licensed thing. I mean, that's the thing, like, with...
Well, I mean, the Diamond numbers are what the Diamond numbers are, and that's, you know, orders to comic shops in America, you know. And that's the thing. It's like a lot of people look at the Diamond numbers as kind of like the be-all and end-all of sales. And they're not. I mean, they're an indicator, right?
Yeah.
But, you know, and they're accurate for what they are. It's just they're not everything.
Yeah.
You know, there are other pieces that kind of slip through the cracks that, you know, we've talked about on the show before. You know, you look at something like even like an Archie comic, you know, it's like those things, they sell a lot of those through, you know, still through Walmarts and grocery stores and newsstand and stuff. And none of those are reflected in the numbers through Diamond.
Yeah.
But, you know, the Diamond numbers are what the Diamond numbers are.
Yeah. I think that's the same thing with these video game comics. But I think it's just an attempt to get out to that audience. I mean, you have to think about, you know, they'll sell. Like, I mean, when Uncharted number 3 comes out, they're going to sell millions that day. Millions on day one.
Do you know if this is going to be part of the digital program? Because it seems like if someone could get it digitally, you know, it's like, or even through the game console,
Yeah, I imagine this will be day and date, just like everything else. You know, I think they're trying to do with a lot of the books now, not just the 52. If not day and date, then at least within that month, you know, get it out there to them ahead of time. And I'm sure there'll be previews released early because the game comes out right before the comic. I mean, they're going to push it. I mean, you saw in San Diego, they were giving away posters of it, you know, so it's, especially at the Sony booth. They were actually giving away posters of it, of the Adam Hughes cover that was talking about promoting the comic book at the Sony booth to anybody who came up to the Sony booth. So it's like they're definitely pushing it to that audience, which is good. I mean, I believe in options. You know, if we can get just, there's no raw problem with trying to get people who are video gamers into comic shops.
If you can get them reading this comic, then you could, you know, just get them reading a comic.
And then it's up
to they'll read some other comic.
Yeah, so the comic shop, I mean, if I remember when I worked at a store and I was a manager of a store, somebody came up to me and the only comic I saw them buying was a video game comic. I mean, right now, if I was working at a store and a guy came in just selling Uncharted and he said, you know, he walked up and was like, I'm buying this Uncharted comic book and that's all I'm buying, I would definitely recommend some stuff with that guy. I'd be like, really? Let's look at this over here. What do you think of this? You know, I'd be like, we have this right here. And in some instances, back when I was a store manager, I would basically, like, if I knew it was a number one of a book, like, or if it was another book I could recommend that was number one, and I had overstock of it, I'd be like, take it. Just take it. You know, I'm not going to even charge you for it. And then hopefully they come back and remember that and get hooked on it. Because I think people, when they get something, they try something out for free, they're more likely to come back. I mean, that's what we always talk about. If comic shops can do better deals, but that's what, you know, it always comes down to. It's up to the comic shop at that point. You can only get them so far, you know. It's up to the comic shop at that point to try to get more people to want to buy those books. But yeah, I think Uncharted, it's definitely a fun book. It's really adventuresome. The art's great. It's by a guy named Sergio Sandoval, who's doing really cool looking pages. It's really exciting because we want to try and make sure the book was exciting as just as the video game could be. So yeah, there you go.
Very good. Well, thank you very much for taking the time with me, and we've got two great comics here for people to give some thought to. They're coming up, both of them, on your September order form. Again, Xenoholics, you've got issue number 2 on your September order form. If you didn't order number 1, think about going back and getting your shop to order the number 1 for you on your August order form. And Uncharted number 1 is here in the DC section of your order. Thanks a lot, Josh.
No problem. Thank you.
And I'm now talking to Shane Houghton and Chris Houghton, who are the brother and brother team who bring us Reed Gunther from Image Comics.
Hello.
Now, Shane, you do the story and the lettering, and Chris, you do the pencils and inks.
I write, and I also do the lettering. Chris actually taught me how to do the lettering, though, in the first couple of issues, so that was kind of the training ground, but I think I'm rolling right along with it now. But Chris does actually a lot of the sound effects as hand lettering, just as he's drawing, so it's kind of part of the composition.
Do you do the lettering, do you use one of the lettering software packages? You're not doing it, or are you doing it by hand?
No, I do everything in Adobe Illustrator, and everything that I've learned in Adobe Illustrator, I have learned from Chris, because he is a pro at all things Adobe.
Now, let's talk about Reed a little bit. And I'll just, you know, Reed is a Western hero, and he's got a bear named Sterling, and it just has always tickled my fancy that, you know, you see this cowboy riding along on this big, lovable grizzly bear. But it's also an all-ages book, and the thing that I like about it as an all-ages book is that while it's completely suitable for kids, it's not written down. You know, it's not something that I look at as an adult and read and say, oh, wow, you know, I can't read this because it's too kiddified. And you do a good job of treading that line, I guess, of keeping it accessible and making it a real all-ages title.
Yeah, well, that's great to hear. I mean, that's what we've been trying to do. We recently sent out a comic book press release, just kind of a different style of a press release. And it was just talking about that exact kind of subject that, you know, both Shane and I want to create, you know, stories that are really all ages, and that all ages kind of has a stigma around, you know, that's for kids, that's a kiddie book. and we really don't want, you know, Reed Gunther to have kind of a false, you know, kind of idea around it, where people are confused as to what it is, and rather just say, oh, it's a kiddie book, and it's not for anyone in particular.
Yeah, we definitely don't want to make a book that, you know, we don't enjoy making or reading. And, you know, we're in our 20s and we're hanging out and we want to be making books that we think are really fun and exciting and adventurous and that have real stakes and real danger and adventure in it. And so I think if we were to, if we actually set out to make a kid's book, it would be something that is not what it is right now, because we're not trying to make a kid's book. We're trying to make just like a fun, funny adventure book. And it just happens to be that, you know, kids can also enjoy it as well as folks of literally all ages.
Great. Now I'm going to let you guys kind of give the description of Reed and his world. And I'll also talk a little bit about this story arc that we're in right now, because what we're specifically asking people to keep an eye out for and to make an order for if they haven't been getting Reed in monthly issues already is the first trade paperback that's going to be on the September order form, shipping in November, and it's collecting the first five issues of the Reed Gunther series and that first story arc. So I'll hand it back over to you guys to just talk about Reed and his world and that first arc.
Sure. Okay. Well, Reed Gunther is a bear-riding cowboy. He rides through the Wild West with his buddy Sterling, and they fight supernatural creatures and monsters. In the first issue, they come across a giant steak, snack, and snake, which is basically this giant water snake that's eating cows, and they have to figure out how to stop it. The first issue is a completely standalone issue. We wanted to do that just, you know, so people feel comfortable. They get a complete story when they first started out. In issue two, we kind of start a storyline that continues on into issue five, and that is kind of our first trade, is issue one through five. And in issue two, Reed and Sterling venture into some caves underground, and they kind of meet all of these mole creatures. There's hordes of mole creatures, thousands of them. And they seem to be protecting this mysterious idol, which Reed, of course, kind of happens upon. And he mistakenly removes it from this cave where it's been for many years, and that sets off a chain of events that really gets him into a lot of trouble. Basically, this idol creates monsters and crazy things for him to encounter, especially in the next issue when they run into a zombified version of John Henry back from the dead. As they're chasing this idol across country, it's been picked up. The idol's been picked up by this freak show owner, Mr. Pix. He's kind of a dastardly fella who was collecting all these Wild West beasts and creatures for his freak show back in New York City. And so he thinks this idol will really help him out, getting some folks in the theater, and so he is taken aback, and Reed's got to kind of fix all these problems that he's started and clean up this mess he's made, and so his adventures will take him to New York City, where monsters are reigning supreme, and of course, with all these brand new monsters that are being created and are popping up all around town, you know, it definitely catches the attention of the government. So President Grover Cleveland decides that he is going to assign a special agent to hunt down Reed Gunther and this idol and find out just exactly what is going on. So there's a lot of obstacles against Reed, but he's just out there trying to help him and his friends kind of get by day to day, maybe get a warm, hot meal, maybe a couple pieces of gold, and probably a great night's sleep. I think that's what Reed will want most of all. But that's in general, kind of where we're going with the first trade. Actually, it's pretty in-depth, what I just said.
I've been enjoying it in single issues. Now, you guys had done some comics that were self-published before you brought it to Image. Was that, now in those issues, were those the similar story or were those completely different stories that were done under your own imprint?
All the Reed Gunther stuff that we've done before now at Image was stuff we were just self-publishing, and Image has been reprinting them. So I think it was the first four issues we self-published on our own, but they were just in black and white, and we were just printing them up in very small runs. They weren't distributed through Diamond or anything. And then I think it was after our third issue, we were then talking to Image, and they decided to pick us up. And so it was time to get all of that old content into color and reprint it. But Shane and I have also done some other like non-Rejumper stuff, little comics here and there. We did a little horror comic called Blood Brothers that Shane wrote and I drew. And that was just a little 8-pager that some folks might remember picking up at a Comic-Con. And we also did, people might remember, a little digital distribution comic we did called Moon Gloom, which Shane and I did as part of the 24-hour comic book day. But we actually did a 14-page comic in 14 hours, so, and between two people. So between the two of us, we did half of one man's work.
That moon was really fun. It's basically the moon, the Earth blows up in the very first panel, and then the moon decides he needs to find a new planet to orbit. And so he runs around the solar system looking for a new planet that's a good fit for him. And we experimented distributing digitally just by ourselves online through the Recon4 website to see how that would go. And I think it was a great experiment, but I'm very happy with applications like Comixology and things like that, because they do it way better than we did.
Now, let's talk a little bit about, you know, we've said, okay, this is an all-ages story. It's a Western, and it's kind of a, I would say it falls into the kind of, it is a comedy, you know, it's lighthearted, let's say. There are humorous elements to it, you know, it's not like you know, Kid Colt, Outlaw, Rawhide Kid, which, you know, people might have expected, you know, Reed Rides a Bear, although I suppose you could have, you know, like some, you know, old-timey Marvel guy riding a bear that's, you know, kind of played straight and is sort of unintentionally funny. You know, I don't know that they actually did that, but you've got more of a purposeful, lighthearted air to this. What kinds of things would you say, if somebody likes X, they should also like Reed Gunther? You know, if you have to explain that to people, how do you usually go about that?
That is a tough question. But, I mean, Shane and I have been big fans of things like Star Wars and Indiana Jones, these big movies and franchises that, you know, they're not marketed as all ages movies, but they pretty much are. They're fun and funny, but they're also adventurous, and they've got lots of elements of danger and some really evil bad guys. And you know, it's not necessarily, again, going back to that whole, it's not really a kids movie, but it's not necessarily inappropriate for kids. But yeah, I think if people like something like Indiana Jones like Ghostbusters, I think they would like.
We sometimes get compared to Bone, which is a really super high compliment for us.
I can see that. I can see that comparison. That's a good one, because I've read Bone also. Cool,
yeah.
I think that's
Bone is so adventurous and so fun and scary, and like that's exactly what we're going for. That mix between adventure, fun, and a little bit of fright, a little bit of, you know, the kind of thrilling danger side of things.
Right. Okay, so that's a good one, and I hadn't thought of that before, but that's a really apt comparison, I think. You know, so people who enjoyed Bone and are fans of Bone, check out Reed Gunther. It's set in the Old West, but, you know, that's kind of like, you know, the trappings. You got trappings of the genre, but, you know, just like Bone was set in, you know, whatever fantasy world of Boneland, whatever it was, you know.
Yeah.
It's not like it was only appealing to people who liked, you know, kind of high fantasy or Lord of the Ringsy kind of things, you know.
Exactly,
it kind of crossed different kinds of desired genres that people like, and it was more just, you know, that good all ages kind of adventure mixed with a little humor. And I can see the Indiana Jones comparison too, because even though that's a lot of pretty straight adventure. I mean, you do have, you know, when he pulls the gun and shoots the Arab guy with the sword, or when, you know, Marion smacks him upside the head with that mirror, you know, kind of thing. I mean, there were those humorous elements in that movie as well as the, you know, straight high adventure kind of stuff. So I think you're right. You know, when you have any kind of thing, when you mix in that little element of humor, it is characteristic of that kind of adventure story.
Definitely. And that's funny because I think it was wasn't long after we were doing maybe issue one or two, and we were watching Raiders of the Lost Ark, and I can't recall the name of the actress who played the love interest in that film.
Karen Allen,
that's right. And both Shane and I were like, oh man, she's a great like Starla. But I'm sure we were a little influenced by that. She probably drank more than Starla, though. I don't know, maybe not. Starla's a rancher. I bet Starla could really hold it. Probably she could drink us both under the table, probably. Just like, didn't she drink that like everybody in the bar? And then she like is totally cool and like cleaning up. It's like after she just like destroyed that like bald guy drinking him under the table. That's insane. That's insanely impossible. Yeah, she sobers up really quickly in that scene.
Well, you know, I will encourage. Do you have some? Well, we have the that ad that you mentioned, and I'll put a link to that in the show notes. If you've got another sample of Reed that people can check out that's online somewhere, I can put a link to that in the show notes also. I will encourage people to check these out, and you know,
that'd be great. We actually have a 4-page complete story. It's a short story that we have that Comic Alliance ran as an exclusive called Animal Intimidation. And it's a real short story about a town that's in trouble of being attacked by some ghosts, and Reed's going to teach him how to look a little bit more ferocious, like similar how he does by riding a grizzly bear. And so it's just a fun little story, but we'll send you the link, and your listeners can take a look.
That'd be great. You know, and I encourage anyone who just likes lighthearted adventure that is not completely heavy, you know, as you know, for me, I like it. It's different than anything else I read. It's a great palate cleanser for me, you know, mental palate cleanser, let's say, you know, in between reading, you know, some different kinds of books, you know, in between reading some superhero book and, you know, Walking Dead, you know, Blue Estate or Parker or something that's like a real crime, you know, kind of thing. But there's a lot of heavy kind of comics that you read. And this one's just a great, fun, you know, read that I can just sit down, I can read it, and I can enjoy it. And I would say particularly people who have kids, that you're trying to get your kids to enjoy comics, and maybe even if you want to read your younger kids some comics, this would be a great comic book for any of the parents out there listening who've got younger kids, let's say. I mean, because some of the older ones can read it for themselves, you know, but if you've got any kids that are, you know, 4 or 5 up to 8, you know, 8, 9, that you're still reading stuff to, you know, pick up Reed, and you can read that, you know, read to your kids. And when they get, you know, if they're a little older, you know, and they're reading really good, they can just pick the comic up and read it for themselves. And you could read it, and then you guys can talk about it with each other, you know.
That's a great point. Yeah, and we love hearing, you know, we'll get emails in from parents and a couple of teachers who talk about how they can introduce, you know, some of the kids they know or have into reading by using some comics like Reed Gunther, and that's really, really rewarding. And I also wanted to just say about that press release comic that we released about a week ago. Shane and I were both, we talked a lot about that comic before we put it out, because we wanted to be sensitive to the fact we didn't want to in any way say that all comics should be for all readers or anything like that. We love that there's a lot of diversity on the shelves, and that you can go and if you can pick up a kid's comic, if you can pick up an all-ages comic, teen comic, more adult story. It seems like, we read a bunch of different titles from underground comics to stuff like The Goon, which is kind of an in-between indie title and maybe, you know, more older teen. And then we read, I love Little Lulu, and then I love Johnny Ryan stuff. We like that diversity, and we want people to, give everything a shot. And if you're into kids comics and all ages stuff, that's awesome. If you're not, if you want to give it a try, totally do. It will not hurt your stance on the comic shop. Diversity is a good thing.
No, I agree with you. And like I said, I mean, it's, to me, reading different kinds of comics, it's just changing it up. You know, it keeps it fresh, you know, at least for me. You know, I don't like to read the very same kind of story over and over and over again, because it just gets monotonous for me, and it would tend to cause me to burn out if I wasn't switching it up and reading different kind of things. And that's what I like about all the great diversity that's out there in comics, is that, you know, you can read something that, you know, it's not like anything else that I'm reading. And especially when it's well done, you know, that's what'll earn something a place on my pull list.
Yeah, definitely. And I think, we're reading a lot of, you know, mature titles as well as all ages titles, and we're influenced by a whole, you know, rainbow of different types of books. I just finished reading Death Note, which is a manga, like, big long series, about 12 books, and it was the first kind of manga series I had ever read, and
we're behind the eight ball on that. Sorry to tell you, we're
I know, right? I'm just getting started. I loved it. I thought it was phenomenal. It was great. It was unlike anything I had ever read, so that was really cool. And then, yeah, being able to balance it with something that you could also read, to your kids, I think that's a phenomenal idea. I mean, that's what Chris and I do. I read in comics every night before he goes to bed. Keeps him asleep.
Gives me nice sequential dreams.
Very good. Well, thank you guys for joining me. And check out the links in the show notes. Check out the samples of Reed Gunther. This is definitely a book that if you want to check it out, you can pick up the individual issues. They're coming out even as you listen to this. Or you can ask your shop to make sure that they order a copy of Volume 1 of the Reed Gunther trade paperback so that they'll have that for you to purchase in November. And you definitely want to do that, because don't just assume that your store will have a pile of them on the rack. They'll have them there if you express that interest and you tell them that you want to check out Reed Gunther.
Yeah, and another good selling point, if you're on the fence about that trade paperback, it's 184 pages. A lot of trades seem to kind of max out at about, 112, 120. Our first five issues are all 30, 32 pages. The first issue is 30 pages. After that, 32 pages of story. And then we'll have a ton of extra sketches and stuff like that in the back.
That sounds like a great deal to me.
That's right.
Well, thanks very much for joining me, guys. And I'm a big fan of Reed Gunther, and I'm happy to help promote it. And I hope some of the people who are out there listening will give it a shot. And especially would love to hear from anybody who tries it out, if you like it for yourself and if you like it with your kids. You know, let us know how your kids like it and how you like it, because it's the kind of comic we could use more of on the stands.
Well, thank you so much, Bob. We really appreciate talking to you, and thanks for all the kind words.
No problem.
Yeah, definitely. Thanks a lot.
Hey, everybody. It's Amber Love from Amber Unmasked, and today I am talking with Kevin Freeman, the creator of Subculture, the webcomic. Kevin, thanks for joining us today.
Howdy. Thanks for having me.
So the reason that I brought you onto the show is because you have a solicit in the latest previews.
Mm-hmm.
So that's what we're going to talk about today. Subculture is, it's been going for how long now? How long have you been out there on the web?
Let's see. We started off as a 4-issue comic book series, which started in 2007, and we've been doing the web comic since February of 2008. So almost 400 strips now.
That's a lot. That's a lot of material. So when it comes to the geek humor, which is, as if people can't guess by the name subculture, that's what you're focused on, is life in a comic shop surrounded by games and comics and video games and everything. What makes subculture different from, you know, all the other geek strips out there?
Oh, gosh. You know, there's so many geek strips out there that it's really hard to separate yourself from the herd, if you will. But I think we do a pretty good job in that. We go outside of the realm of geek to some degree. You know, it's not just a bunch of guys hanging out in the comic book store talking about nerd stuff. So we go beyond that a little bit. I think we've got a pretty diverse group of characters who all have their little quirks, if that makes sense. So they're not all the same. They all reflect a little differently on the geek culture, on the geek persona. And I think probably the thing that most separates us from the rest of the other ones out there is that it's sort of grounded in reality, and that our characters aren't just one-dimensional. They have lives. They have relationships. They have personal issues. I mean, it's not all just about, oh, her boobs are big. It's not all that kind of stuff.
So yeah, and you have kept it, like you said, pretty grounded. You didn't sprinkle in any supernatural elements.
No, and lots of people ask if we're ever going to do that.
No talking animals.
Hmm. Create an imaginary character, or have aliens from outer space show up. While they're interesting ideas and they sound like a lot of fun, it's hard for me really to move away. I kind of like it being grounded in the real world.
So what is the story arc of volume 3, because that's what I saw in the solicitation.
Right. Well, if I can share you on a funny story before I get into that too much. Volume 2 was skipped in previews, and the reason why apparently is that the sending of the solicitation of volume 2 kind of got lost in the maelstrom, and we sent the solicitation for 3 when it was supposed to, and so when the time came to send all those things to Diamond, the solicitation for 3 got sent, and the solicitation for 2 never did. So what we're going to do is 3 is solicited this month. We'll solicit volume 2 next month, and then if all goes well, we'll send 2 and 3 to retailers at the same time. So hopefully, if people are wondering, oh, where's volume 2? That's what happened, so don't freak out too much. What kind of storylines can readers expect in this volume? Well, we really start to introduce the rival comic book store in this one a little bit. Dave Dwanch, a friend of mine, a friend of yours,
yeah.
Comes. He did a little fill-in strip for us when Stan Yan's wife was having a baby. We decided to introduce a rival comic book store, a rival game store that opens up in town, and a lot of this volume's revolves around that and some of those other things. There's also a pretty big storyline in Volume 3 where Bart, who's our comic book store owner, he finds a bunch of old valuable comics in his storeroom and that he thought he had lost, and so there's a story that centers around that. And we have a little beach storyline. I think it ends with the annual going to the big convention storyline, and that continues into Volume 4, which should be out probably by Christmas.
And is it necessary to go back and having read them in order? Like since there's this problem mix up with getting volume 2 right now?
No, I think they'll be all right. They might, because volume 1 kind of cuts off in the middle of a story. It's not real bad, but it cuts off in the volume of a story. So if they pick up volume 3, I think they'll be all right. They might not have a lot of familiarity with who the characters are or anything, but they can always go back to the website and look up stuff there. Unfortunately, we don't have a Meet the Characters section in the first 3 volumes. We're going to correct that in Volume 4. But I think they can pick it up without having a whole lot of trouble, and because the jokes are pretty universal.
Are you relaunching, Kevin?
Am I relaunching?
No.
I don't think so.
For September, you're just not going to name all of your strips number 1.
Yeah, I might. I don't know. We don't stay too current when it comes to news that's going on around the comic book world or the gaming world. Part of it is because Stan and I stay pretty far ahead. We're usually about two months ahead of when things actually air, so it's hard to be too current. But I try to sneak something in there every once in a while. But no, we're not going to relaunch with a series of number ones.
But I did notice that you stay current more with social topics, maybe not necessarily, you know, up to the minute comic book stuff, because, like you said, you're ahead. But when it comes to social issues,
mm-hmm.
you do seem to mix those in, where it's not just jokes about comics and games. You know, you've got characters that are dealing with their weight issues and mm-hmm. gender issues and, you know, a love life and things like that. So
yeah, and that's
how important is that?
I think it's really important. It makes the characters human. One of the criticisms that this strip and other strips that do similar kinds of stuff get is that the characters are very stereotyped. That they say that they're one-dimensional and that they're just big nerds and they fulfill all of the ideas that people who are outside of the genre have of the comic book collector or the gamer or the role player or anything like that. And again, I think by having them have regular issues that anybody has, not just geeks, but people who are outside of the realm of geeks have, it allows everybody to relate to these characters and not just you and me and the other people who are hanging around the comic book store who are rolling dice. So I like the human aspect of the strip. Again, I think that's probably the one thing that separates us the best from everything else that's out there.
Which character, if there is just one, you've created them, which character do you find you connect with the most? Because my guess would be Noelle, but I'm just guessing.
I get asked that a lot. We've got about, I don't know, 13, I think there's 13 major characters right now. And yeah, I'm sort of halfway between Jason, who is our everyman, and Noelle, I would think so. I mean, I'm sort of a closet geek. I teach at a university, and I for the most part keep it on the low down. I mean, I don't advertise the fact necessarily to my students. I'm not sure what they would think, and frankly, I really don't care what they would think. But I try to keep that excuse me on the low down a little bit. And then I have a lot of Noelle in me, in that I'm passive aggressive, although I'm not quite as passive aggressive as she is, but I do a lot of observing, and I watch a lot of people, and I watch a lot of behaviors, and really that's what keeps the strip going, is that I am passive aggressive just like Noelle is, and the strip becomes a way to kind of vent, I guess, about the industry. The big storyline that we've got going right now with the convention storyline is kind of a jab at San Diego and a lot of the other big shows out there, and how hard it can be for small press to really make a difference or to get noticed at these kind of shows, and how hard it is for small press to kind of get their foot in the door, which is a passive-aggressive poke at some of the big shows out there. So
yes,
that's
probably my favorite run so far.
Oh, good. I'm glad. It's the longest, too. It's in 36 parts is what it's going to be at by the very end.
So that one can be like its own volume in and of itself.
Almost. Almost. I mean, we do two a week, and so 36 parts means it's 18 weeks. It lasted, four and a half months. That's a long time for us.
Do you take breaks? I mean, or do you just make sure that you have enough in the can?
I just make sure that I have enough in the can. I always worry about, it's never happened before, but I always worry about getting writer's block. It happens to everybody, even the best writers out there, of which I am not. And so it's always nice to have a little bit of a buffer there, just in case I do get hit by the writer's block, to have 10 or 12 out there that are ready to go, just in case. But luckily I haven't so far, and the material comes very naturally.
And it's because you vary between the number of panels that you're writing for. So how does that factor into your writing process at all? Is it just a matter of you let the panels sort of follow your own beat, or is you work that out with Stan?
No, I do it myself. It's hard to explain, but you just kind of get a feel. I mean, you've written scripts also for us even, and I mean, sometimes you just know when something is going to be a one-panel strip or a two-panel strip, or whether it needs three or four. You can just feel it when the idea comes into your mind. So there really is no rhyme or reason to it. It's instinctive, really. You know what it's going to be, and mixing it up keeps it fresh and keeps it original. I agree.
Because there are those out there that follow a very, very formulaic approach, where it's like it's always four panels,
mm-hmm.
you know, regardless of, you know, unless there's a big splash or something. But it seems, you know,
yeah, probably
it seems that you have variety.
Probably 60% of our strips are three panels. We've got a few, and then we go four, one, and two. I think we've had maybe one five-panel. And every once in a while, like for an anniversary or for some special thing, we'll do a bigger strip. But most of the time, three. Tends to be our rule of thumb, but if the joke carries needs more, if it needs fewer, I'm fine about doing that.
How does it work with Stan when it comes to the whole characters and the design of the comic shops and the, you know, and, any of the background. You just say, you know, draw me a geek in a t-shirt and let Stan run off with it.
Pretty much, yeah. Tend to keep it very open for Stan. I'm not a rigid writer. I don't want to be a rigid writer because, let's face it, well, in my opinion, at least the artists, they're the ones who, how do I want to say this? When people look at the characters, the impression of those characters that they get is probably going to be more from the artist than it is from the writer. Does that make sense? So I give Stan a lot of creative freedom to do what he wants with the characters. I'll have a few little ideas. Hey, I'd like this character to have XYZ. But other than that, go to town. And a lot of the designs, a lot of little jokes that you see in the background, those are all him. I'd love to take credit for it, but I can't. And he's very easy to work with. I mean, he is the consummate professional, which is very refreshing. You know, he's never going to be late on a deadline. You know, he's always going to do things that he's supposed to be doing. And he takes
I'm losing you a little.
He takes constructive criticism very well. And plus, we're about the same age. We have the same life experiences, so that it makes working with Stan very easy.
That's awesome. How did you meet him?
on the internet. I mean, I had this idea for a comic book, and I advertised it on a couple of the websites where you can do this kind of stuff. And as irony would have it, I got about 100 solicitations, about 100 artists who submitted samples to me of their work to try to get the original gig. And Stan's was the very first one that I got, which is kind of funny. And his is the one that I ended up taking.
Yeah, it works very, very well because he's got a very clean line, not oodles of shading or anything like that. So it helps with the comic,
right?
The comedic aspect of it.
And I wanted somebody who could draw caricatures, could draw funny stuff, but at the same time have some grounding in reality. In other words, has a grasp of anatomy and mm-hmm. perspective and how that sort of stuff works. So he's a very nice hybrid. I think he's a perfect artist for this strip. And we've had plenty of guest strips, and I've loved almost all of them. Well, I've loved all of them that everybody else has done, but Stan is still kind of the one that I compare everybody else to.
Cool. Oh, very cool. Well, we definitely hope that there's many more to come. That's for darn sure.
Well, here's hoping. As long as the ideas don't run out, we'll keep doing it. As long as there's readership, we'll keep doing it. We'd love the readership to get higher. There's always room for growth. We'll never be one of those strips where we can quit our day jobs, I'm sure, but that's okay. I mean, we do it for love, we do it for interest, and if people are paying attention, if people are checking out the website, if people are buying stuff from us, that's power to us.
Do you have any conventions left for 2011?
I haven't decided. I've got stuff ready for New York, just in case. But if I do New York, that'll be the very last one. Most of my I work at a university. I'm a college professor in real life, so a lot of my convention visitations are restricted to the summer. And New York, of course, is during October, so it's hard for me to get to a show, particularly one that's pretty far away from my house. When I don't have a whole lot of time. So maybe New York. I've already got a hotel reservation. I don't have a table, unfortunately, but I've got some friends who'd be able to help me out, just like Noelle's getting helped out in this current storyline.
That's right. I've done that. You have very kind friends that let you freeload at a table.
Right. So I have New York on the list. Whether I go or not, I'm not sure at this point. But I did Chicago, Wizard World Chicago this year. I did Heroes Con. I did the CGS Super Show. So I did 3 or 4 shows this year. We'll see if I – one more maybe.
Well, that's my favorite show, of course. But
Super Show?
It's so intimate. It's just small and relatively contained.
And I make more money at that show than I make at any other one for that very reason. It's kind of an insular – I hate to use the word I won't use that word because I'm totally drawing a blank on it. But it's sort of it's a very closed – closed makes it sound bad. Everybody knows everybody else, and so the selling portion of that convention is easier, if that makes sense. Because everybody kind of knows who you are, and so it's an easy sell. You really don't have to pitch quite as hard, and so I move a lot of books at that show.
Well, hopefully. I know that your schedule, you've booked a really big trip for next spring, so I don't, we don't have the dates yet of the convention season for next year, but hopefully we will definitely get to see you.
Yeah, I should be there as long as it doesn't conflict with I'm taking students to Germany in May next year, so as long as it doesn't conflict with that one, I don't see any reason why I wouldn't be at Super Show again this year.
Cool. All right, well, yeah, because it's kind of hard to sometimes, like you said, track people down at the big shows, because I'll definitely look for you if you're at New York.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, hopefully some of the Comic Book Page listeners will be in New York as well and able to find us, because the small press area got a little bit ignored last year, I think, by a lot of people.
Again, one of the problems that I have with some of the big shows out there is that little guys, small press, podcasters, all those people, sometimes they get lost in the shuffle.
Yeah, I mean, it sounds like a good idea. Like, hey, let's give them their own space, because they're, you know, they're together and they're like their own little, you know, collective. But at the same time, you know, whether it was the construction of the Javits or whatever, I have no idea. But I had a lot of people tell me that they never even found me last year.
Mm-hmm. Is it going to be like that this year, too, then?
I really don't know, because last time I was past the Javits, there were still cranes and construction things all over. So I have no idea what to expect. But for, let's see. Subculture Volume 3. Mm-hmm. We've got The Return of the King's Throne on page 226 of the latest previews.
Yeah.
And it's a soft cover, black and white, 96 pages. And let's give a plug to your websites, of course, where they can find the current strips.
You bet. It's www.subculturecomic, one word. Not Subculture Comic, one word, but Subculture Comic as one word, .com. You can catch up with that. It's got archives. It's got an online store. So everything that you need is right there.
And there's comments. One of my favorite things, of course, is to read people's comments as they reflect upon that strip.
I wish we got more to it. I find that really frustrating. I don't know why. Maybe it's just ego stroking or something else. But I like it when people comment. And a lot of our rival strips, who I'm good friends with, don't worry, but a lot of our rival strips will get 2 and 3 times more comments than we will. And I'm like, come on, man, let's see what we can do to get more comments for us. But So every comment is appreciated, even if they're negative, although we don't get a whole lot of negatives. But it stimulates a lot of discussion, and I like it when our strips stimulate discussion. So please leave a comment if you like it, even if you just want to say, hey, nice strip, I enjoyed it. Stan and I read all of them, and we respond to all of them.
So subculturecomic.com, and you have a Twitter feed too, right?
I do.
Noelle, or no, is it Noelle's Twitter feed?
Noelle has her own Twitter feed. That's right. It hasn't been used quite as much, but yeah, she has her own. It's gee whiz. Now I'm going to draw a total blank on it, but yeah, she does have her own. I'm looking it up here as we speak. She has her own Twitter feed where she is passive aggressive to everybody. I used it a lot during Chicago Comic Con, but not as much lately. It's Noelle_subculture is hers. And then if you want to follow me for some strange reason, mine is kfreeman13.
All right. Well, thank you, Kevin. Thank you so much for joining us and giving us all the information on Volume 3.
My pleasure, Amber Love. Thanks for having me.
And hopefully we will see you at New York Comic Con. Thanks, everybody, for tuning in. It's Amber from Amber Unmasked. And now back to the guys at Comic Book Page.
And we are now talking to Tony Parker, Eisner-nominated artist for the Do Androids Dream of Electric Sheep series that he's recently completed over at Boom Studios, and now is doing a new series with Greg Pak for Aspen Comics called Dead Man's Run. Thanks for joining me, Tony.
Thanks for having me. Great to be here.
Okay, Dead Man's Run. We are starting out with a zero issue. You're doing it with Greg Pak, who's coming off his long run on the Hulk over at Marvel. And let's talk a little bit about what the high concept is for this series.
The elevator pitch is prison break from hell. And the worst part is I'm very cautious of what I say about it, because there's some stuff that I know that hasn't been announced yet, and I'm trying to keep it straight in my head, but it's takes place a bit in the future. It's just basically like a year after tomorrow, a couple of years in the future. And it's if I remember what I can say right, it's basically hell. There's a hell prison on Earth. So that's I think that's something that it's safe to say. So hopefully I'm not ruining anything, but I've actually read the issue zero. I'm almost finished with my work for issue zero, and I've never had to slow my down so much while reading a script as I've had with this case, because I've been looking like, what happens next, what happens next, what happens next, and I've actually had to actively, like, okay, let's try to make sure I'm not missing any details, like switching the characters while I'm reading through it the first time. So it's just, I mean, I'm very lucky to have yet another great writer to be able to work with.
Right. So the solicit here says they call the prison hell, and they just might be right. The nation's toughest soldier heads into the world's most deadly maximum security lockup and uncovers a world of terror and temptation beyond his darkest dreams. So that kind of tracks with what you're talking about there. Now let's talk a little bit. I want to start out talking about the art, and then we'll move into talking about your collaboration with Greg on this one. But on Androids, right around issue 13, I think it was, you switched your style up a little bit, going from the straight line work to adding some ink washes to the series, which I personally really enjoyed and I thought was a really nice texture added to the art for the series. Now, what's the art like? You know, is it more like the line work or is it more like the ink wash work on Dead Man's Run?
Dead Man's Run, currently it's all line work. We're talking about maybe playing around with things down the road, but for right now it's, and right now the line work really seems to fit with it, since it's a bit sharper and a bit more contrasting thing, style to the series. It's very, a lot of spotted blacks, a lot of heavy black patches, just give that really dark horror mystery feel to it. And it was just a great thing. I was very lucky, and actually back about the ink wash, that actually all came out because that was the first art I did after I was somehow lucky enough to be on a book that was nominated for an Eisner. And I realized, you know what? I've really got to, I've got to jump it up a level. I've got to jump it up. I'm like, what can I do? Well, it's, I'm going to be absolutely insane, and I'm going to add a grayscale to it. I'm going to add an ink wash and some pencil work to it. And for all the people that, the creatives out there, I was, that meant I was doing 22 pages of pencil, ink, and wash on a 28-day schedule, which is insane. More, a lot of creators have issue with just maintaining 22 pages for a pencil for the 28-day turnaround. And it just, I looked at it and realized, I've really got to do something to really make this book that much better. The odds are it wouldn't matter with the voting, because all the books, that, the issues I'd done wouldn't be out until after the voting with them, but just the realization of, with this added attention, I really had to bring it, bring something additional to the table, essentially. So I'd gone through and, again, go through the pencil, everything, get those approved, ink, and then when the ink was done, use either a combination of, start off with just an ink wash, then off to then to a gouache, which is more more like a watercolor, and working with that. And then after that, working with that and Copic markers and a pencil and basically every single tool I could pull out of the sandbox. It was, and again, I really liked, when I came about, I really liked how it turned out. It just, that really added to the texture, added to the feel, and also really helped the creative team out as well, because that allowed the colorist, Blonde, who did just a beautiful job with the series, allowed him to be able to focus more on playing with, having fun with it versus having to worry about basic total quality. So he enjoyed it more. I think I just, even from the editorial side, I just asked, hey, do you mind if I do this? And the response, I think, was like just the two words, yeah, sure, or go for it, where it's, as long as I can keep the deadlines, that was the primary thing. But it ended up doing really well, and it's one of the things I really liked with it. But back to Dead Man's Run, this has, again, much more starker, cleaner, crisper quality, but we're talking about playing around with it just for the thematic things in the future. So we'll see how that goes.
Who's the colorist you're working with on this? I didn't see it listed in the solicit.
I'm actually, right now, I'm not too sure. I know I was lucky enough to just have Peter Steigerwald do the colors for the for the cover for it. So that's actually, that's one of my bucket list colorists. I was incredibly, I mean, I've known Peter for many years now. And just be able to work on a property with him made me giddy. So as far as on the book, I'm not too sure, but I know a lot of the colorists there at Aspen, and any one of them I'd be very lucky to be able to work with.
Now, let's talk a little bit about how you got brought into the project and your working relationship with Greg. You know, it's like full script, you know, how you kind of tossed around the designs and stuff, you know, back and forth with Greg, and if, you know, Peter or any of the other people at Aspen were involved in that process, or just you and Greg, how did that
work?
Yeah, no.
Actually, it was, I've known Aspen for a while. I've known the guys at Aspen for a while, the Greg guys and girls, great team all together over there. And it's just been, I mean, either I've been busy or they've been busy, just trying to find that right, matching the ball to kind of catch us both at the right time. And I was very lucky that I told them that, hey, look, I got time. Do you have anything that I would work with? And they're like, yeah, actually, we do. We got this. What's your schedule look like? So we talked about where I was able to work a schedule out, and thought it was just a great meeting. Well, actually, not meeting, but a great series of emails with that. And finally, we were able to actually meet and sit down and talk with everyone. So I was actually able to talk with, in a meeting with Greg, with Frank, and actually with Valhalla Productions, Galleon Hurd, who produced the movie Aliens, Tom Shane Punisher movie. They do their The Walking Dead TV show. So I was able to get in there and talk to them and give a few suggestions. But one of the great things for me with this is everyone pretty much knew what they were looking for. And so that frees me up to really play with the designs. So therefore, like, when I went through and started designing characters, I'm like, what are you looking for? What's the characters? What's the concept? What are they like? And so with that, I can go take their notes or their suggestions, and I'll do, like, I think each of the characters had at least four to eight costume designs. Like, how does this work? How does this work? And did multiple headshots to get a good feel for the character. Partially because Greg and Ethan have been really thinking about this for a while. So I have a feeling they really know what they're looking for. And it's one of the things I really want to come in, I want to add to it. I want to embellish it. I don't want to take it over. Obviously, don't want to take it over as my own, but more play with them. Like, hey, how does this character work? Or how would this? Or you mentioned here you're looking for something with this. How about we put this in there? And they've been great with it. They've been absolutely wonderful with, I mean, the freedom they've given me. And when they've had suggestions, they don't have to, but they've been telling me, we don't want to do this because it conflicts with this, or we really want to work this because I think this kind of character would fit better. I'm like, wow, that's great. You're absolutely right. Let me redraw that. So it's been a great, and actually, again, very freeing experience. I was actually been very lucky with that as well, with Androids and with this, where, and some of the other projects I've been working on, that I've been very lucky that I've been allowed that freedom to, like, play around with stuff and add nuances to things.
That sounds really cool. Now, we're getting a zero issue. That's what we're soliciting here. It's a 12-page story. It's supposed to have some extra sketchbook material, from you. And then we're going to get the number one issue, I would assume, next month. It's on a monthly schedule?
I believe so. I know that Zero Issue comes out in November with actually a pre-release at the New York Comic Con. And then in December is an issue one.
Okay, great.
So as far I'm pretty sure it's monthly. We're going really far in advance, and it's like I think it's a zero issue, and I think five or six issues after that. I'm not too sure specifically with that, but it might.
So it is a limited. You know, there's going to be like a trade's worth of.
Story. It's a complete story volume. So you know, I mean, that's how I like to look at it. Where you could sit down if you wanted to give it to a friend, like here you go, here's the story. On a couple of evenings, you can enjoy the whole story without having to worry about like 20 big old damn Dave Sim service thing. Where while it's great, it can be daunting. It's something much more easily accessible to people who might not normally read comics. So it's again really excited with that. My big thing right now with all these things is I want to make sure I make all my deadlines. So I've always hated when I've had to, like, wait a week or two. I mean, one thing is shipping. You feel no control over that, but when you hear of it, it's like kind of wait. I mean, because the art is laid on a book, sometimes stuff happens, but I hate it when that happens to be me. So I'm going to do everything I can to make sure that everything makes deadlines, and I know everyone else down the chain will be doing the same thing as well.
Well, it's good that somebody in comics is worrying about that lens.
Again, I've been a fanboy of longer than I've been a professional artist, so I love me my comics, and it's one of those things where sometimes it's production, sometimes things just get in the way. I've had that happen to me before, where books have been late because they got caught up in the customs. And a lot of times that's usually what happens with stuff that people have no control over. But if I'm given a deadline, I'm going to do everything with my power to give the best product possible to whoever's reading it.
Well, it does, in my opinion. You know, as a fan, it does tend to kill momentum on a book if there are sustained delays. You know, it's like one issue is late, you know, that's not a big deal, but it's like if it's an ongoing thing where every issue's late and you're just kind of losing the thread of the story. I mean, in the large scheme of things, you know, as the work of art, once it's completed, it's a trade paperback and it can be sold and someone can sit down and read it as a, you know, standalone story. That's fine, and that's what will persist, right? But for the people who are supporting it as it's coming out, it's really hard, you know, if you're reading a bunch of different things and living your life and watching TV shows and going to movies and stuff, to kind of hold those story threads in your mind, you know, when there are huge 3, 4, 6 month or more gaps in between issues. So it's really great. I always love it when I talk to someone and they, you know, they're way far ahead, or, you know, they're really committed to making sure that at least they're going to do everything they can to make sure that the thing ships on time.
And it's important it's finding that balance between the two. Well, because sometimes, yes, it would be nice to give that extra day or two to, yeah, I mean, improve the product. But it's, again, it's finding the balance because there are multiple venues for the product and trying to make sure everyone's happy. Thankfully, I learned how to draw relatively quickly, so, especially for the style with which I draw in.
So are you getting full script from Greg at this point?
Full script. It's wonderful. I mean, he's getting a full script, but he's also great about, like, asking, hey, if you got questions, let me know. He checks his email on a regular basis, and every once in a while asks, like, hey, how about if I put this in there? Do you have any problem with me throwing these on or something like this? And again, he's been great with that, but no, it's a full script. I mean, it's a full script. I think a lot of people still believe that, like, the Marvel method still exists out there. And I'm not saying it doesn't, it's just it's incredibly rare. Where the most you'll have anymore is, you throw in a fight sequence by two pages, you're making sure that this happens and this happens. But outside of that, it's more, other scripts I've read from either friends who are writers or friends who are artists or other colleagues throughout it. More and more people like that. I mean, you're more likely to see that type script because that way the editors know what they're going to get, the writer and the artist know have the ability to play more around with what they're given. Some people I know love having a loose script. I like mine a bit more complete.
Does he go down to the level of, you know, calling out camera angles and, you know, background and all that, or does he leave some of that up to you?
It varies, but he's got a great eye for it. So when he looks and he's like, can you do something like this, or wide shot here? I'm like, you know, that's a perfect place to put a wide shot, or this is great. So if he's got something specifically in mind, it's great about it, but it's one of those things where it's not like a Neil Gaiman or an Alan Moore script where it's, okay, page 5, panel 2, make sure that in the lower right-hand corner there's a Coke can, but the Coke can, isn't the label is not facing, but you can see the barcode, and the barcode is missing. Where it's, yeah, it's important, but stuff like that, or nothing with the barcode, just having such specific control over the image, which, yes, can make it easier, but sometimes if it's too easy, it almost gets boring. But no, he's been great. I mean, it's a great riveting script and great characterizations with it. So as I'm reading through, I'm like, again, I just slow myself down, and he's good enough, he does a great job with it, so when I was doing the layouts, it almost wrote itself. Where it's like, okay, this is going to be here, this is here, this is here, and there were a couple of corrections because the way I envisioned it was different what they're looking for, and other times what I did wasn't what they're looking for, but they thought it turned out great. So there's a lot of play there, but it's he's a professionalist. He knows how things work. So again, it was just a couple of places, but he made it incredibly easy for me to visualize when going through and doing the script or doing the layouts for it.
Cool. Now, when you were working on Dados, was someone taking the novel and doing the breakdown, or was it pretty much, here's the novel, Tony, break it down? And
frankly, you know. No, it was. I got that from Boom, and they did an amazing job with it. So I was very, very, very lucky and very happy that it ended up that way, because that would have been incredibly daunting. And again, I can tell it took a lot of effort to do that with.
Oh yeah, I would imagine, you know, that was non-trivial. I was always curious, and I don't think I asked you before, so that's thing to hear.
It's a common question. No, and I'm very happy with it. They did an amazing job with it. So I was very happy to have to deal with that. So they did. I mean, the book started off a bit compact, but it really, they did a great job pacing it out with it. And even with that, there are a couple times where I might have added or subtracted a panel. But obviously no dialogue has changed. It was just, okay, let's combine this, or let's speed it up here or slow it down. But they, again, they did a great job with that as well.
Very cool. So, I mean, I kind of like the Aspen when they do the zero issues because they're a little cheaper. They kind of give you a chance to, you know, sample the series at a lower price. When there is something like what you're describing here where you're getting a 12-page story that is, you know, starting and building the momentum and, you know, depending on how that story is structured, you know, is kind of going to suck people in, right?
Yeah.
And have you teed up, like, I want to read issue one now. Sometimes you get zero issues from, you know, different publishers, and, you know, it's nice that they're putting sketchbook material from you in it, and I like seeing that stuff, but I don't want to just get that. You remember back years ago, you'd get these zero issues where all it was maybe a couple of pages of story from the first issue with no dialogue and then a bunch of sketchbook and, you know, conceptual stuff. That doesn't give you as much of a feel as getting here.
They've done a great job because I've actually got the zero issue for Haunted City, and that was an incredibly fun book as well. And that great thing about that, like with what I've got with Dead Man's Run here, it's a great intro into it. It's a great filler. Kind of, it drops you like, okay, now who, there's all these people. I mean, here are characters you're going to see throughout the book, but here's a story that introduces them, and Greg does a great job of introducing all these characters where it's not, hi, my name's Bob, I do stuff. It's character and author simple lines and character interaction. We're like, okay, I've seen two or three lines explain the concept of this character, how this character feels, how they deal with things. So he does just a great. He's been just doing a great job with that.
Very good. Well, I am looking forward to it. It will be on my November order form that we fill out in September. Everyone. So if you want to check out Dead Man's Run number zero. Standard thing that I always tell people, go to your shop and ask to order copies of this book, because you just can't assume that your shop is going to get a pile of every book that Aspen comes out with, unfortunately, but they hopefully will if you ask for it. So if this sounds interesting to you, ask.
And this is one, I mean, for right now I'm finishing up some of the pages, like the pages for the zero issue, and some of the best art I have done. And if you don't like my art, the story is worth it. I'm not selling people on my art, I'm selling people on the story. Just a great book to read. So, and I read the first issue already. And they're lucky.
Very good. I am looking forward to it. Thanks a lot for taking the time with me, Tony, and I'll be looking forward to November. Now we're talking to Scott Chitwood, co-publisher of Red 5 Comics, who is also the writer of a new series in the September previews coming out from Red 5 called Dead or Alive. Thanks for joining me, Scott.
Thank you for having me on. I appreciate it.
Now, Dead or Alive is a kind of a zombie western, the good, the bad, and the zombie.
Yes, exactly. That's right.
Let's talk a little bit about how you came up with the idea.
Well, it was kind of unusual. I don't know if you know, but I am a reviewer and writer for ComingSoon.net and SuperheroHype.com, a couple of movie websites. And I occasionally do set visits for the website. And I was on the set of Cowboys and Aliens. And we were there watching them film the big finale. You know, I met Daniel Craig. And, you know, you can tell from the title of our company, I'm a big Star Wars geek. You know, and Harrison Ford starts walking up, and we weren't supposed to talk to him, but he started walking up to us. And I said, hey, you know, how's it going? And he goes, oh, good. So how does this work? You write nice things about us, and, what he said was, we're nice to you, and you write nice things about us? And my brain just shut down. I mean, Harrison Ford says that, and I went, yeah, okay. And then he walked off. That was it. That was my Harrison Ford encounter. But anyway, we had a lot of fun on the set, and we were driving back, and me and the other press members that were visiting were talking about, you know, Western mashups, you know, the mashups of the genres. And, you know, we were throwing out all these funny ones, and somebody said, you know, hey, what about mashing up a Western with a zombie horror film. And then somebody jokingly said, you know, you could call it the good, the bad, and the zombie. And everybody laughed, but then I thought, ah, you know, there may be something there. And then, you know, by the next day, on the way to the airplane, I had already come up with the plot of this story in my mind. So that was the genesis of Dead or Alive, believe it or not.
Well, I really like, you know, the fact that, you know, and for the listeners, Scott was kind enough to provide me a review copy of the first issue, so I've read the first issue. Our two protagonists, the living ones, end up, you know, they're bounty hunters. You know, they kind of fall into bounty hunting, and it's kind of cool that you got, like, Dead or Alive, you got the wordplay between all the Western Wanted posters, Dead or Alive, you know, Wanted, Dead or Alive, and then zombies and people, you know, Dead or Alive. So that's kind of cool.
It seems so obvious. I was frankly amazed that nobody else had done it. But after some Google searches, you know, I found a few zombie Westerns out there, but I found that nobody had connected Dead or Alive with a zombie film, or a zombie Western. So I was really happy about that. That doesn't always work out that way when you're writing some of these comics and trying to come up with titles. But it worked out perfectly. And, you know, it was real fun to write a story where, you know, these two down-on-their-luck cowboys, you know, have this opportunity, sit down in front of them, and, you know, they can, the opportunity of catching the most wanted outlaw in Texas. And they go and they capture him through sheer dumb luck, but, you know, little do they realize he's been infected by this zombie virus. So you end up having kind of a midnight run type story where the character is dragging his bounty all the way across the state trying to get him to collect the reward. But at the same time, the bounty's trying to kill him, trying to get away, and all the other problems you typically have with a zombie. And then, of course, making matters worse is the other outlaws chasing him, the other bounty hunters trying to steal him away, and, of course, the Comanche trying to eliminate the zombie threat that nobody else realizes is potentially going to spread through Texas. So it was a real fun action story. You know, that's the kind of stuff we like to do at Red 5, is fun action adventures, and this fits that genre.
Your artist is Alfonso Ruiz. Where did you find Alfonso?
We actually worked with him on Abyss Volume 2. He was our penciler on that series, and he did a good job for us, and we liked his artwork. He was well paired with colorist Gary Henderson, who did fantastic work, really took Alfonso's art to the next level. It was kind of fun to I hired him for Dead or Alive, and only afterwards did I realize he had never really drawn a horse before, so he had to learn on the fly here, but he's doing a fine job, but he's drawing a lot of stuff that he doesn't typically draw, you know, like trains, horses, Indians, that kind of thing, so doing a bit of research along the way.
Fortunately, it's nowadays pretty easy to call up images from the internet for kind of whatever you want to draw. I always think back, you know, when artists used to have to go to the library or something, like,
oh, no down, kidding.
You know, almanacs and magazine articles and stuff.
Yeah. I don't know how they did it. I mean, and it helps the writers too. You know, you go do a Wikipedia search if you're doing research on various things. And the internet has really allowed us as an independent publisher to find talent out there that we never would have been able to, you know, hook up with before. You know, we've used artists from Australia. Alfonso's from Mexico. My publishing partner's in Calgary. I only see him once a year, and that's at San Diego Comic-Con. The rest of the time, we're doing everything over email. So it's amazing comics got done in the 80s, so, considering everything was pencil and paper and sending everything through the mail with couriers and such. And then, of course, you know, we're doing the digital distribution as well. So the internet really changed the comics industry from top to bottom.
Are you moving these books? Will any of these books be day and date like a lot of the other publishers are moving to, or is there going to be a lag?
We typically have a lag of about a week. You know, that lets the publishers, I mean, the retailers get their sales out there, but it's still soon enough to keep the fans happy, you know, fans of the digital distribution.
Sure, a week's not bad. It's better, you know, it's not like it's a couple of months or something like that.
Yeah, you know, and a lot of the retailers, you know, aren't happy with the digital distribution, but the fact is that, you know, the digital distribution is a small percentage of our business. So, you know, like most publishers, the print is where we make our bread and butter. So we definitely want to keep them happy.
Well, I mean, to me, for a company like Red 5, mm-hmm. digital's got to be a boon in that a lot of comic shops either don't order Red 5 books or they don't order that many books. And if something gets some buzz and someone wants to check out a title, you know, they go to the shop and the shop doesn't have it. And the shop calls Diamond, and, you know, Diamond is not always most forthcoming about, you know, giving a couple issue reorder of a publisher from the back half of preview. So it's really difficult for someone to get their hands on a print copy of that book, maybe, whereas digital, go on Comixology, you know, click, click, and there you have it.
Yeah, that's the real nice thing about digital distribution for independent publishers is, you know, you put your comic out, and it's on the shelf for 1 week, and then it disappears, and it's only one title amid all the Marvel and DC. So it's really hard to get noticed. But on the digital storefronts, like with Comixology and iVerse and Graphically and all those, you know, you could be right on the front page with Marvel and DC, you know, being a featured comic, and that puts you on equal ground with the Marvel, with the big two, you know, and even the bigger indies like Dark Horse and IDW. So, you know, we were one of the first publishers on the digital, or the iPad, iPod, those formats. So luckily, you know, we were there before the field got really crowded with the others, so we got a lot of attention that way. It's a tremendous advertising tool for us. And, you know, and you can, you know, we're still making a little bit of money off of comics that we put out back in 2007. So, you know, you've got a perpetual comic on the shelf, and, you know, people can discover it years later, and, you know, it's new to them. And then they can go to the retailers and find the trade paperbacks and stuff. So, you know, it's a great tool for the indie publishers like us.
Yeah, I know, speaking of, one of my favorite Red 5 titles, one of my favorite titles overall is Atomic Robo. I just love Atomic Robo.
Oh, yeah, everybody loves Atomic Robo. It's a real fun series to put out there. It's
hard to find that book on the rack, and it's kind of a combination of not that many copies get ordered, but I think when copies do get ordered and go out on the rack, they don't stay there that long because people pick them up if they look at it, and it's like, hey, this is great. They buy it, but as a result, it doesn't have a very long shelf life or shelf presence, but it's there on digital. And if somebody wants to read that, and it's such a great series, they can go out and they can read it, you know, that way. I think also, and I don't know, maybe I can ask you, the response that you get from those great free comic book day issues that come out with the new story of Atomic Robo in them. I mean, those are wonderful, and, you know, hopefully those are bringing more fans to Robo, because those get into the hands of a lot of people.
The free comic book day is our best advertising, you know, for the dollar. You know, it's our biggest print run of anything we do. So, you know, it gets it in front of most people, and, you know, the Atomic Robo guys always knock it out of the park with those free comic book day stories. I mean, they started making it a tradition of showing Dr. Dinosaur, which is
a hilarious Dr. Dinosaur.
Oh, yeah. I just saw on Twitter Dr. Dinosaur having a verbal battle with Brian Clevenger. You know, definitely. He's hitting below the belt, but he is evil. Anyway, yeah, so, our first free comic book day story with Dr. Dinosaur, people were clipping out individual panels and sharing them around as, you know, kind of fun pictures of the day and that sort of thing. So, you know, that's really good for us as far as getting the word out there about Atomic Robo. So,
wouldn't it be great with each one of those pictures to, you know, have a link to where somebody could just buy that comic.
I wish, but fortunately, you know, most of the time when somebody posts it and, you know, somebody says, this is funny, what is it? There's usually someone in the comments section that knows it and points them back to Brian and Scott's site. So, you know, usually people are able to track it down relatively easily. But, you know, one of the problems with Free Comic Book Day is, you know, even though there's a lot of copies of the comic out there, the shops only have it if the retailers order it. So, you know, even though it's our biggest print run, there's a lot of shops that don't get it. And there's a lot of Atomic Robo readers that say, you know, come back to us and say, hey, my shop didn't carry it. So, you know, we're still, every year the numbers creep up more and more on, you know, how many copies they order. But there's still room for improvement, and that's what we're going for. But, you know, distribution is one of our biggest problems because quite often, you know, an Atomic Robo fan will come to us and say, hey, my store says they can't order this comic. And, you know, here I'll be sitting on dozens and dozens of copies of that comic, but I haven't gotten any orders from Diamond. And, you know, I can't send the comics until I get an order. So it's an ongoing struggle. It's something we're working on with Diamond and, you know, trying to make sure we get our comics out there to the readers. But it's definitely an ongoing struggle, especially with, you know, places like Borders going out of business. You know, you got to find more outlets to get the comics out, you know, to the readers. So we still haven't figured it out, and we've been in business since 2007. So, but yeah. So, but you know, like you said, there's always the digital versions that are out there and available. So that helps.
Yeah, and you know, I think everyone, well, dead or alive, if you want to read a fun, and this is one thing about this is it's a fun zombie western. You know, there's like your kind of hardcore horror ones that are all kind of gory and stuff. This is a little more of a lighthearted, it seems, zombie western. It's good fun.
The more the focus was on the action than the horror and the gore. Now there is some horror and there is some gore, but you know, that's not the focus of it. You know, kind of like Aliens was sci-fi horror, but was more on the sci-fi side. You know, it was this is more on the adventure side than the horror side. But we, sorry, my brain shut down for a second.
You know, I think Alfonso's style kind of softens, you know, the horror elements a little bit, makes it not, even when someone's getting ripped up a little bit, it's not as bad as in the hands of some other artists who really go for the entrails and all that kind of stuff.
That's right.
It's a little more tastefully done, I think.
Yeah, you know, and when we started this, one of the things we asked ourselves was, is there room for another zombie title on the shelf? I mean, because there's obviously a glut of zombie comics and of zombie movies and novels and everything. I mean, it's everywhere. But when you look at the ones that are doing well, it's because they're doing something different with it. I mean, you look at Walking Dead, and it's more about the drama between the characters. You look at World War Z, and it's about you know, a real-world approach towards, you know, what would happen if a zombie virus broke out. And, you know, we'd have another zombie title that we did called Zombies of Mass Destruction, ZMD. That was actually created by the guy that did the Underworld movies, and we actually sold the movie rights to it, and they're shopping around the script of it right now. And, you know, it was looking at the zombie genre from the perspective of a military action adventure. So, you know, what we're bringing to the table with this one is we're taking a lot of the Western tropes and throwing the zombie spin on it. Like, you know, we have the characters, you know, riding horses and jumping on a runaway train. Well, the runaway train's filled with zombies, which they find out as soon as they're on board. You know, we have the big showdown with the cowboys and Indians, but the zombies are thrown in the middle of the mix. So it's a lot of fun stuff like that, and the action ramps up every issue. You know, the first issue is a lot of setup, but, you know, it gets more and more intense as the series progresses, and it's a four-issue series.
I would encourage everyone that wants to read this really fun zombie western to ask your comic shop to please carry this book, because they're not going to necessarily have it on the rack for you if you don't ask them for it. But any good
shop
that you ask.
We rely on the pre-orders. And I have to mention the great cover by Matt Bush. You know, he's a well-known Star Wars artist. He's been doing a lot of zombie versions of movie posters. He calls the series Hollywood is Dead. And he just did a really nice job with our cover. And he also did our Afterburn covers, which was a mini-series that we did, which we also sold the movie rights to. And, you know, they've been talking with Gerard Butler about starring in it. So we're still waiting to hear if that's going to go ahead. But we've got a lot of fun stuff going on with Red 5. And this is the latest, Dead or Alive.
And check out the always fun Atomic Robo, current series Atomic Robo and the Ghost of Station X, issue number 4, is in this month's previews. And again, ask your shop to carry that.
Yeah, and this latest series, this is volume 6 of Atomic Robo. And I got to say, the first issue is on shelves. Issue 2 of that series has what I think is the best action sequence of any of the Atomic Robo series. I think people are going to have their socks knocked off. You know, we always make fun of the comic companies that say, you know, everything changes, nothing will ever be the same. Well, you know, they really do something interesting with Atomic Robo in that second issue, and every fan's going to want to check it out.
Well, I'm looking forward to it.
Your jaw is going to drop open. They you wouldn't believe how badly they batter Atomic Robo. So it's going to be a lot of fun. Be sure to check it out.
Looking forward to November, and I'm looking forward to actually before November now for my Atomic Robo and the Ghost of Station X.
And we also have Bonnie Lass, which is the pirate adventure with a girl pirate. It's a real fun action and humor mix up in kind of an alternate world where there's pirates as well as technology. And that's a title that we did on the Comixology. We did it digitally first, and it did so well that we decided to move it over into print. So you should be seeing Bonnie Lass in stores in the next couple of weeks.
Very cool. So that's that one went in reverse order.
It did.
Digital first and then print.
That's right. You know, it's a good way to try out some series and see what kind of reception they're going to get before you invest a lot of money in the print. So, you know, we did that with Moon Girl. Moon Girl was digital first, and it did so well that we moved to print, and now we're doing it with Bonnie Lass. And we're doing it with another series called Cubicles, which is a sci-fi comedy. So you can find all those on Comixology, iVerse, all those apps. And we're on the Nook now, too. Atomic Robo, another series I wrote called Drone, Abyss, all of them are on the Nook, the Color Nook, so be sure to check those out.
Well, thank you for joining me, and as our people who are longtime listeners of Comic Book Page, they know John and I are always speaking highly of Red 5, so you should definitely check out their product. Thanks for joining me, Scott.
All right, thank you very much.
The show notes and forum for this podcast can be found at www.comicbookpage.com under the podcast and forum sections of the website. Please email us at theguys@comicbookpage.com and let us know what you think of what was discussed in this episode. Thanks for listening.